someone. It's a case of someone who was not Jewish, who had no connections genetically to Judaism, who finds his way in the pre-modern world to Judaism. He finds his way into the Jewish community. Now, why is that uncommon in the pre-modern world? Any ideas? Why is that kind of a strange situation or somewhat unique? Yeah. Okay, so there's just the basic social reality, right? Things are pretty segregated. And from a legal perspective, any ideas? Yeah, my question is, someone who, to convert to Judaism in the pre-modern world, in other words, before emancipation, before equal rights, and before religion is really a choice, to convert to Judaism was a very rare choice and a very rare happening. We have very few cases of it throughout Jewish history in the post-Korban stage. Any ideas why? Why is that the case?
Well, the church had for centuries been demonizing Jews, so the idea of somebody wanting to join such a despised people is pretty...
Okay, so there's demonization. Excellent, which all the major religions looked at Judaism, which was their older brother, as this kind of failed project, in terms of the nicest way to say it. But certainly, there's a lot of demonization going on both in Islam and in Christianity. And what else? Anyone? Yeah. Okay, you were losing a lot to become a Jew, right? As opposed to in other societies where possibly to become Jewish gives you status. Like in the modern state of Israel, many people who come as temporary workers to convert gives them all sorts of status, and so it becomes a very complicated contemporary issue. But in the medieval period, it wasn't so good to be a Jew, right? Yeah. Yeah, that's the number one reason, right? Is that if you change from Christianity to Judaism in a Christian country, or from Islam to Judaism, or to Christianity for that matter, in an Islamic country, you and anyone who helped you would face the death penalty. And so the cases we have of people converting to Judaism are people who end up leaving where they're from and kind of go and go to a foreign land, often going from Europe to an Islamic country and vice versa. Spain is a place where you see some cases of this because the different regions are all contiguous geographically, but you can move from one place which is predominantly Muslim to another place which is predominantly Christian, and people won't remember who you are, don't know who you are, and you can kind of blend in. So generally speaking, the converts we have records of, which again is going to be smaller than the amount of converts because for these reasons, people aren't going to talk about it, are people who end up giving up everything, really. They give up their family, they give up their money, they give up their language and their culture, everything to be Jews. And so these are, generally speaking, very, very high-level people. And that's why one of the most famous letters we have of the Rambam, he writes to Ovadia Hager. And Ovadia Hager writes the Rambam, he's very concerned because people are saying that he can't say Elokei Avotenu, right? He can't say that the God of my fathers. And the Rambam, in the very famous, beautiful letter, reminds him that he, by connecting to Sinai, is connecting to the Avot. But that, again, is a very unique situation. The Rambam understands what this person had to sacrifice in order to become a Jew. So it's a pretty unique situation. Now, the 17th century in a place like Amsterdam, one could question very strongly the determination of that as pre-modern. It's clearly in the camp of early modern, what historians in the last generation have started determining as kind of an intermediary phase between the medieval and the modern period, where you see, depending on the place, certain attributes which we associate clearly with modernity, freedom of conscience, expression, much more choice in the way people structure their lives, much more speed in the way things are conducted, communication and business and whatnot. But at the same time, there are many of the same hierarchical structures and religious notions that inform life. But Amsterdam is a very unique town. It is today. It was in its inception. And although not all religions and not every expression of religious diversity was accepted and tolerated, a lot more was tolerated in Amsterdam than it was in almost any other city in Europe. That's a pretty fair wager. And so Amsterdam was a place where you had a lot of religious change. It was a place where people who were expelled for their radical religious ideas, generally radical Protestant ideas, found refuge in Amsterdam. And it was a place where the free market spilled over into the free market of ideas in a very strong way. And for that reason, the Jewish community of Amsterdam was, you know, Ir Be'em Be'Yisrael, really the Jerusalem of the North for many, many generations. For that reason. And I want to step back before we get to our particular case and talk a little bit about the wider, what I call the Atlantic world of the 16th and 17th century. Starting in 1492 with Columbus's transatlantic journeys and the waves of different explorations and establishment of colonies, of European colonies throughout the Americas and also East Asia, we have a very different sort of world. We go from the medieval world where, in Europe at least, we are locked in. Generally speaking, you're born and will probably die within 5 miles of where you were born, to a place where people will cross the oceans several times in 1 year. Where people will pick up and move around based on their economic needs and opportunities, where the old notions of literally where the world is in relationship to the sun, in relation to where the continents are, what the continents are, who are people, what does it mean to be a human being, all these big questions start bubbling up, and we start looking at a truly globalized world, which is organized globally through economic needs, but also and political desires and ambitions. And if you see this map here, it's kind of abstract, but the red accounts for what? Anyone any ideas? What? Excellent, okay. These are Portuguese territories. Portugal is a small sliver of a country. It's mostly coastline, very few natural resources besides grapes and cork. Cork goes good with grapes. You need them to stop the bottles. And already in the early 15th century, the Portuguese are pushing the limits of the Atlantic. They're establishing colonies throughout Western Africa, on the coast of Western Africa, and really set up, on some level, the template of what the Spanish will do and then what the other European countries do later. And you see here the wide variety of places, obviously Brazil, which is the largest, but also throughout Africa. And if you see it, this really tiny dots when you get to India and East Asia, the Spice Islands. And the Portuguese had this very vast trading empire that during the years that they were joined with Spain, you had an even larger, vast Iberian world system where Iberian, meaning Spanish and Portuguese, territories and colonies were all connected, developing, exploiting natural resources throughout the world. And as we know today, things haven't changed that much. What do you need for businesses to run? I mean, you need a lot of things. What are some of the things you need for multinational, long-distance businesses to run? Okay, language. Excellent. What else? You need access to ports because ports move things around. What else? Okay, communication, methods of communication. All right. You also need a lot of capital. Remember, I put all this gold on the ship. I send it off. I don't know what's going to happen to that ship. It's going to be a while till I see the payment back. It could sink. I need people to come up with insurance plans. I need financing. I need to have a network of people that who can trust each other. And it's in this area that the Sephardic and Converso merchants become very important in basically greasing the wheels of this economic engine. Sephardic Jews in open Jewish communities in places like Italy and Ottoman Empire, along with Amsterdam, along with Converso Jews, in other words, Jews who converted generations back and never left Catholicism, but maintained family and business ties with open Jews, they were able to create this web of businesses that connected all these major ports. And depending on where one of these individuals was, their religious identity often shifted. So if they were living in Lisbon or in Madrid, they obviously would live like Catholics. If they would move to Italy, they would have a choice. They could remain Catholic, or they could decide that what they really wanted was to live as open, proud Jews and go to the ghetto in Venice and become Jewish. The same thing was true in Amsterdam. So this is a very kind of strange situation. You have people who, depending on where they are shifting their religious identity. People who, when they're living in Catholic countries and ostensibly as Catholics, some of them are maintaining Jewish religious ideas and practices secretly. And this shift is happening often because people are moving around because of their businesses. This is the wider world that we're discussing. The Western Sephardim are often differentiated from the Eastern Sephardim in the sense that the Eastern Sephardim are for the most part, Jews who left Spain and went to mostly the Ottoman Empire after 1492 and never had this converso, for the most part, didn't have this converso phenomenon happen to them in the same way. These are people who, when they had the choice of exile or conversion, chose exile, and they left. They maintain ties with those Jews who remained and converted, but it's not the same situation. And they are the people, in the Eastern Sephardim, mostly are the ones who settled in the Ottoman Empire, also Italy. They are the ones who speak Ladino, whereas the Western Sephardim, who for so much of their history stayed in Spain and Portugal, or in Portuguese and Spanish territories, the language that they maintained was Spanish, as it was spoken in the peninsula, and Portuguese. And in fact, any works of poetry in the Sephardic community in Amsterdam and other Western Sephardic communities were either in Hebrew or more commonly in Spanish. And it's a Spanish which is, you can't tell a difference between a Sephardic poet in Amsterdam writing in the 17th century or one of the great Spanish poets in Spain. They read the same works, they were totally conversant with the same period language. And all the kind of banal documents, the ledger books and all these things, the Haskamot, all those were in Portuguese. And that was kind of the structure of the community, how it was structured linguistically. So now we get to our individual. This is just to give you a sense of the world. This obviously is very summarized, heavily summarized. But we get to our individual here, Manuel Cardoso de Macedo, also known as Abraham Pellegrino Guerre. Pellegrino, like the water, it means pilgrim. It means pilgrim, which also has a connotation of convert. And so Guerre is kind of the Hebrew translation of his new name. And just to give you a brief sketch of his life, he's born in the end of the 16th century in the Azores. The Azores are North Atlantic islands that were colonized by the Portuguese. And they're kind of midway between Europe and America, closer to Europe though. And his father, again, was part of this Atlantic world, although he was an old Christian, which means that he never converted, no one in his family ever converted. One of the interesting, bizarre features of the history of this time is that the conversos who were at first welcomed and encouraged to convert from Judaism to Christianity. After a generation or two, there became a trend within Spain and Portugal to look at these converts as not really good Catholics. And we start to see an almost racial form of anti-Semitism developing that differentiated between new Christians, the converts, and old Christians. And this runs through Iberian culture into the 19th century. And people work hard to hide their new Christian status, forging genealogies to show that they're always been old Christians, they've never been converts. And it's a very bizarre cultural trend. But it's one of the things which kept the identity of the conversos distinct from the rest of the population. In other words, you could assimilate all you want. You could go to the best universities. You could advance as much as you want. There are always telltale signs in society which were reminding you that you were different. And this is one of the ways that many of these individuals were prompted to leave Spain and Portugal and go to free, open Jewish communities and embrace their Judaism fully. And so this is just part of this larger story. But Manuel Cardoso de Macedo was an old Christian, as old Christian as you can get. There's not a drop of Jewish or Moorish blood in him from any side. His father was a very proud nobleman, had a thriving business in the dye trade, and imported a lot of his wool from England. And so he wanted his son to apprentice in the business, and so he sent him to England to study. He comes to England 1599. England, of course, at this time is fervently Protestant, and Manuel, the young 14-year-old who's sent off to study at Exeter and perfect his English, is coming from a very devout, pious Catholic background. It's a little bit tough, right, in that situation. And he basically, as we'll see in the text inside, just to give a brief sketch, he, in England, gets very enamored and very excited by these new ideas of Protestantism. He takes advantage of his freedom, being very far from his family. He converts. He's a very passionate Calvinist. And eventually, on a trip home, is found out as being a Protestant and is sent to the prisons of the Lisbon Inquisition to kind of straighten him out. And we're going to hear the rest of this story and see what happens to him. He eventually ends up in Amsterdam. So that's how we get back to Amsterdam. But so he is this old Christian who's going to end up following in the footpaths of so many conversos. And yet he can give it all up and go back to being a Catholic without any of the stigmas, with all the benefits. And yet he doesn't. And we're going to see his life story and how he weaves it together. This comes from a text. It's a very, very... It's not a common document. People who come back, even those people who came back, who were conversos, who came back to Judaism in Amsterdam, who often had amazing stories to tell, were very circumspect about it. They were very private about it. We have a handful of accounts of people describing their histories. And so for the historian, it's very frustrating, but it begs the question, it's a much larger question of why. Why were they quiet about it? But that's reality. So this text is very unique. We have very, like I said, almost a handful or more of texts in the Amsterdam library of the Jewish community there like this. And this is a spiritual autobiography that he writes to give praise to God for bringing him out of idolatry into the fold of Judaism and under the Shekhinah's wings. So this is how he starts. He starts talking about himself. This text is written in Portuguese, and it was transcribed in 1976 by Bernard Tiensman, who is one of the important scholars of the last generation of the Dutch Jews. So translations are mine. I tried to kind of capture the way he, the cadence and the tone of the text is sometimes a little bit choppy, so I'm sorry. Who would like to start? Who would like to read the first passage? Any volunteers?
Okay.
No? Yeah. Sure.
The ego of a people so estranged from the Jewish people, of Gentile blood, despised in his eyes, as it says in Malachi, chapter 1, verse 2 and 3, and Jacob I loved, and Esau I hated. Being of a lineage so hostile to his people, to such an extreme, that there would not be sufficient fire for them to finish them all.
So how does he describe his parents, his family?
Unloved by God.
Right, they're despised by God, right, as the verse says very clearly, right? Esau I've hated. And what's their feeling? What is almost the proof of their despised nature is the fact that they would do everything possible to kill every last Jew, to find every last Jew and just burn them. And this theme of wood for burning heretics is something that comes throughout he mentions it. It kind of comes up a lot when he's talking about his family. So here he is talking about himself. He's like, look at me. Look where I come from. I come from this terrible place. So there's already, we start to see an inversion of the Iberian anti-Semitic view of Jews and conversos as being people who can never fully become good Christians. That their rejected status is something that they're tainted forever. This is not official church policy, to be very clear. This was totally anathema to classic Catholic dogma, which saw everyone as reborn in by converting to Christianity. And yet, this became part of this Iberian racial sensitivity, which saw people who were descendants of Jews as being people who could never fully be good Catholics, as somehow always being stained. So he's inverting it into the people who are stained are actually the Christians, and it's the Jews who are the beloved of God, right? So that's where he's inverting that. Yeah, there's a question.
Was it common for them to read Malachi?
Who?
The Christians.
So remember, he becomes... It's a great question. Catholics in general at this point are not reading the Bible unless you're very learned and you're like a monk or a priest. But he becomes a Protestant. And during those years of being a Protestant, he learns the Bible very, very well. So now he goes on to explain why he wrote this document. Someone want to read the next text? You want this side? No. We didn't have our Wheaties today. Thank you.
To give praise to the God of Israel for his great pleasure bringing me to his knowledge in such extraordinary means like these. For all of this, I am continually obliged to praise him for taking me out from among my brothers and giving me a place to give to people.
So who does he thank for making him a convert? God. He sees it as purely miraculous. It can't. How else could have it happened? And then he goes on to tell his story. And all the ins and outs and all the twists and turns of how it happened. How did he get to where he is? So first of all, he's assuming a place of tremendous humility. It's not about him, although in other stage situations he does talk about how it's really is driven by his own thirst for knowledge and for truth. But here he's really giving a tremendous amount of praise to God. And then he explains, kind of gives a metaphysical, explains the mechanics of how this happened. And I mean, I give it the subtitle Gilgul. He doesn't ever use that term, but it's obvious that that's what he's talking about, and we'll see that. Who'd like to read this, the next? Oh, yeah, please.
I believe that my soul belongs to some people Israelite, a fulfiller of the divine law, who have blessed the Lord, who have been merciful to them, kindly with that soul, placing it in this impure vessel, separating it from this path, so that in this way,
so those of you who have had exposure to Zohar and some basic Kabbalistic ideas know that transmigration of souls, Gilgul, Neshamot, is a pretty standard idea in Jewish mysticism. It's a way to explain all sorts of tzaddik v'ralo, things of this nature. It's used to get into issues of theodicy. And it's part of the overall metaphysical structure of the Kabbalah. And one of the ideas is that when you lived your life in a wayward way, you need to come back, right? You need to be, you're given another chance. If God has mercy on you, He's going to give you another chance. So one of the ideas behind this is the idea that converts are part of that process. That it's a process where you put a Jewish soul into a non-Jewish vessel, and so the suffering for the expiation of the sin is being put into that vessel, and that Jewish soul has to find its way back to the fold. So according to the Zohar, there's no such thing really as a convert, because they were always Jewish. It's about finding your path back. And this is obviously, you know, from many perspectives, very problematic, but it does resolve all sorts of issues, certainly once you embrace the Kabbalistic worldview. Now let's go on to see what... I'm sorry, we didn't finish that. If you want to finish that to the last line?
Yeah.
Right. So again, he's thanking God for this. Now, this is just a quote from Gershon Scholem on Gilgul. Luriana Kabbalah placed the Jew in an electable entanglement of transmigrations. These ideas linked an ancient teaching to the conviction of these generations that all things are in exile, that all things must wander and transmigrate in order to prepare through a combined effort for redemption. Remember his self-translation of Ger. Ger is not, he doesn't call himself Abraham Converso. He calls himself Abraham Pellegrino, the wanderer, the person who is in exile, the person who's searching out, the pilgrim. Yeah.
Does that have a relationship to Ger, biblical Ger?
Yeah. Well, because often Gerim are people who come from somewhere else, right? Sure. This was a hot topic at the time. There was certain skeptics in the Jewish community. Around this time, later on, the most famous skeptic that the Jews gave the world, Baruch Spinoza, who was a member of this community, comes out very forcefully and a very breaking with classic religious ideas. But there are predecessors to Spinoza who are living in the community. Many of them are excommunicated. Many of them are living on the margin of the community. The issue of the eternality of the soul, of an afterlife, all these are big questions that are being asked by Jews, by certain Jews in the community, and the rabbis feel it incumbent upon themselves to address it. Here we have a text from Isaac Aboab de Fonseca, whose portrait we have below, one of the major chachamim of the community, and this is what he said in a treatise of his. I'd like to read this. Anyone? No takers? Okay. This is what our rabbis of blessed memory meant when coining the phrase, though he sinned, he is still an Israelite. They intended to convey the idea that though he sinned, he was not cut off thereby forever from the tree, but remained a Jew. And even if he apostatized from the Lord and chose new gods, he will again be called a Jew as a result of transmigrations and punishments. And again, this for a community that was created out of people who lived like Catholics, who had so many of their loved ones remaining living like Catholics, and who know that they're going to have children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren who are going to be lost to Judaism. This was a very important topic to think about, that where are those people going to go? Are they totally lost from Judaism? Will they eventually make it back somehow? So this obviously was a very, you know, a metaphysical and also personal, very, very, you know, dear topic to people at the time. This is to give you a sense that Pellegrino, who obviously did not have a great Jewish education, because he converts later in life and is not very wealthy and doesn't have the luxury to really learn deeply, is clearly in a place where these topics are talked about. So he didn't have to sit and read the Zohar and Parshat Mishpatim dealing with Gilgul from beginning to end to know this idea, that these ideas were in the air in Amsterdam at the time. So let's continue with his search for truth. So this, now after he explains how he got to Judaism and how God showed him the way, he goes to, he starts with his first stop, which is England, where he encounters new ideas for the first time. Remember, he's 14. We can think about ourselves when we were adolescents. We can think about our own children. It's a period of exploration. It's a period of differentiation from your family, of opposing your father symbol, the father figure, and in his case, he has a load of a father figure. His father is a very imposing giant in his autobiography. So let's see what he says. Cardoso describes his arrival in England and his introduction to the study of the Bible. I did not find the sect of my parents to be good. He refers to Catholicism as one amongst many Christian options. And seeing the variety of religions that existed, I did not feel it proper to choose any of them until I could learn more about them and choose which one suited me best. So he comes to a place where people are talking about religion with an openness, with the idea that you could just simply choose which way to go. This is a very early stage in the Protestant Revolution, and it's a place that is going through a lot of shifts. And so he is enjoying this issue. And he describes going to London, leaving Exeter, going on a trip to London, and going and buying 7 books on 7 different Christian sects, and then going and choosing the one which was closest to reason. That's the term he uses, closest to reason. The idea being that this is a personal choice. And for this reason, many people can see the, you know, the beginnings truly of modern sensibility with the Protestant Revolution, where you decide what the Bible means, you decide how you craft your religious journey, and this is clearly what Cardoso does. He comes back often on visits. He keeps his Protestantism secret. Then something happens. His father hears rumors that his son is not so firm anymore. He's gone off the derrick. And so listen to what he says. Someone like to read this?
Son,
okay, please.
Have you said something against our holy faith? Because there is an inquisitional official here to arrest you. If he wouldn't be here because you were a thief, a murderer, or a highwayman, I would save you, giving you my own horse and money. And if I would not have it, I would carry you on my back, because this is what fathers do for sons, and sons for parents. However, for something pertaining to the faith, I would go myself 7 leagues on foot, get the wood to burn you. He responds to Father Zeltry with an equivocal, almost sarcastic response, may God pay your graces this good.
So his father is very clear. I'll break any law. I'll do anything I have to do to save you if you did some, you know, earthly crime. But if this is about God, if this is about the church, then forget it. I'm going to be the first one there to burn you. This is his father. So his father is clearly, you know, and so clearly this is going to set up a tremendous tension. He's arrested, and they think they're going to shake him, just scare him a little bit, and then set him straight. And at first, the local bishop arrests him and says to him, as you see here in the next passage, we know who you are. We know your lineage. We know your family. You're a good kid. Come on, just break it off. And he says, I'm a Calvinist, and I'm going to die a Calvinist. And so he's sent off to Lisbon. And in Lisbon, he goes on and on, arguing with the inquisitors, trying to have... He said, fine, I'll become a Catholic when you can prove to me that it's true. And this goes on for a long, long time. Until finally they say, you know what? Let's a different tactic. They decide to put him in the home of a good Catholic family, and that maybe that will kind of rub off on him. Now notice the difference. A converso who is arrested for heresy would never get this treatment. They are suspected of being heretics, and this is just a confirmation of it. But for him, they really do everything possible to win him with love. Yeah?
How old is he?
So at this time, he's in his late teens. Not much older. But the night before he leaves the prison, he's put in the cell of a Judaizer, right? A converso who is accused of practicing Judaism. And this is an amazing moment. He goes in here, and this Judaizer, Enrique Diaz Milau, comes in with a little booklet filled that the Inquisition basically gave him, pointing out all the things that he's accused of, all his terrible sins of Judaizing. And Cardoso flips through it, and he says, and he has a complete religious epiphany. Wait, I know the Bible. I love the Bible. I want to practice. Protestants believe that the Bible is their book. these people who are accused of these terrible crimes, they're the only ones who are really keeping the Bible. They're keeping all these things that I know are in the Bible, but no one keeps. I can't believe there are people who actually keep this. And this sets him off on a really dizzying night of religious agnosticism, of confusion. If you see in the next page, vertigo. I awoke without religion, erasing the scriptures, no longer believing any of them, and taking it all as a fable. In the end, I was left a libertine. He basically was so thrown by this revelation that he claimed that he just felt it's all lies, it's all foolish. There's no truth. This is crazy. I can't believe this. These people who everyone says were the worst people in the world, they seem to be the only ones keeping the keeping the Torah, keeping the Bible. How can this be? And he decides, you know what? It's not worth it to suffer anymore. I'm going to get out of here. He goes to the Inquisitor and said, "I'm so sorry. I was possessed. I was drunk. I was possessed by a devil. Can't believe it. I want to be a good Catholic." And they let him out. But they let him out, but they put him in a reform school. And this was a common practice for people who were let off with, you know, after the first time, you're dealt with mercy. And in this reform school, his curiosity about Judaism is piqued. And he starts seeking out those people who he sensed were there because they were Jewish or because they practiced Judaism. And he started opening up to them and trying to get as much information on them as possible. When he was released from this reform school, he goes and moves in with a Judaizing family, and they take him in as a brother. They treat him well. He learns about Shabbat and about Kashrut, and he basically, as he says, what?
Which country are you
talking? He's in Portugal still. So secretly, they're all secret Jews. And you see here, in this passage midway down, I began to feel affection for the people of the nation, the Jewish nation, and taking on their troubles like my own. So we start seeing not only a religious shift, but a national and ethnic shift. There's a move in his story where it's not only that he wants to learn about the religion from these Jews. He sees them as part of his people. And the next stage, I know we're running out of time, so I want to just skip a little bit. They decide to leave Portugal. They come up with a plan to leave Portugal, which was not allowed for conversos without permission, and go to Hamburg, which is one of the port cities in the north that gave rights to Sephardic Jews to settle. Amsterdam was the more notable one, but Hamburg and Danzig and a few other smaller cities were there as well. And they were caught. But Cardoso takes the fall, he tells us. He takes the fall. He's the one who allows himself to get caught because he knows that if he gets arrested, they'll let him off again. And they do. And he makes it again. He tries again. He goes to the north. He goes to Hamburg. And in Hamburg, immediately on arrival, he is circumcised. He converts fully. And he becomes kind of a ben bait of the same family that he lived with in Portugal. They have a sugar company in Danzig. And he moves to Danzig to work in their family business. Again, that wider Atlantic world that we're talking about. Where does the sugar come from? It comes from Brazil. So these people who were running away from the Inquisition in Portugal still have business contacts in Brazil, which you can't be Jewish there either, and they're importing the sugar into Northern Europe and refining it in Danzig and then putting it on boats and sending it all over Europe. So this is kind of that larger picture. And he fits himself right there. He's living with them. There's a pogrom, basically. There's a riot against the Jewish family. They're attacked. And Cardoso, again, in his autobiography, describes how he takes the fall. He's imprisoned. And as he says, I would take a month before the inquisitors, the one day in that prison. He comes out of that prison broken, physically. He was tortured. He was hurt. And his physical condition never recovered from that point. After that, he moves to Amsterdam. I believe Danzig was Lutheran, yeah. But there was basically a servant was murdered. Seems that the owner of the house was very rough with this one servant. He died, and then the whole thing was portrayed as kind of a blood libel, and that's what happened there. He moves to Amsterdam and makes his living as a shamash for one of the Sephardic congregations. We have him on the books in 1621, And then again in 1639 as the shamash of that community, which was a very common job for poor gerim or poor Jews in general to take. And that was the way he lived his life. He wrote this in stages. He wrote this document in stages in Amsterdam. And I want to go to the end. If you see the last page, first of all, this is the Esnoga, the Portuguese synagogue in Amsterdam. This is its... Anyone has been to Amsterdam? So you've obviously seen the synagogue. I mean, it's an astounding, outstanding building even today, which, you know, and you go, it was at the time the largest synagogue in Europe, and it may still be, you know, one of the larger ones. And it's a very impressive place. It was a tourist attraction. People knew that when you came to Amsterdam, Goyim, right, would go and visit the synagogue. And for that reason, the synagogue passed very strict decorum rules so that Goyim wouldn't be, you know, they wouldn't be embarrassed in front of Goyim, you know, and that they would keep a very orderly tefillah. But in any case, so he weaves himself in to the Jewish people, first religiously, and then nationally. He gives skin, right? He has skin in the game, as they say. He gives his blood, he gives his body to the Jews. He protects them. He fights for them. And so his integration into the Jewish people is not only a spiritual one, but as he notes, it's a physical one. And at the end, it's clear in the text that he needs to inscribe himself physically into the Jewish people. That it's not enough just to be there out of faith. That he needs to feel that he is somehow part of the body of the Jewish people. And we see this here, how he ends. He ends with the moving psukim that we read on Tanit Tzibur from Yeshayahu. And he Cardoso ends his narrative with the verses from Isaiah, which call out the children of the strangers, right? B'nei HaNechar. All those who were downtrodden, all those who were cast away. God in those last psukim that he quotes here is telling those people, the Sarisim, the people who don't have children, the people who are foreigners, who don't have families with yichus, who think that maybe God doesn't care about them. Maybe God only cares about the royal tribes, the people who are important. And he says, no, we have a place there. We're back. And he ends his very moving life story with these verses to say that I am back on God, that God has brought me to his mountain, and I have my Yad Vashem in the Mikdash. And that's how he ends his life story. He never was married. He was poor all his life. And in fact, there's attached to this document was a dialogue, religious dialogue he has, where he describes running into one of his old friends from England, who was Protestant with him, who was in Amsterdam, and how he hides from him. He doesn't want him to see him. He's so embarrassed by how poor he is and about how sick he is. Because remember, one of the claims of Christianity is, you guys think you're chosen? Look at you. You're downtrodden. You're poor. You're despised by everyone. And so for his old Protestant friend to see him in that state was so embarrassing. And remember, Cardoso comes from a rich family. When this guy met him, he was kind of one of these exchange students with his rich clothes from that his dad sent him with the best clothes and his money, and he would be able to go back home. And now look at him. He's this poor guy in Amsterdam, the shamash of the shul, and he's embarrassed. But then he goes on to describe this, what seems to be very kind of fictional exchange with his friend. But in any case, that's a tattoo. No, he never was married, and he always lived kind of in the margins of the community. There's some questions. I think we have time for maybe two questions, right?
In Amsterdam at that time, as a convert like that, retained the civil and legal rights. In other words, he's still a citizen, and if his father does not disinherit him, does he have rights to the property?
So his father is in a different jurisdiction, right? So, I mean, if he was Dutch and converted to Judaism, that I don't know. I think that is a much more difficult... Amsterdam, you know, it depends. Maybe if he was Catholic, they would turn a blind eye. If he was Protestant and converted to Judaism, I'm not so sure they would be okay with it. You'd probably have to leave. The rules were pretty, and the Jewish community would not accept them because it would put them in a very bad situation with the authorities. The Jews were not citizens in Amsterdam. They had tremendous civil and economic rights, tremendous religious rights. They could build a synagogue that was so impressive in the middle of the town. But they were not. The idea of a citizen takes a while. It takes a while for that to happen, where everyone can just be whoever they want. It's close, but not fully there. But Amsterdam is a place that people from abroad would come. We have several Portuguese and Spanish old Christians who come and convert. We have people from Germany who come and convert. But a local Dutch Protestant who would convert, I think, would be very problematic. But it's a great question. And so there was someone had her hand up before. Yeah.
How did his story become prominent?
Become?
Prominent.
It's not prominent. No. There's been. It was. This, in 1976, it was put into print in an academic paper. I wrote about it in my dissertation. Joseph Kaplan, who's the great expert on the Jews of Amsterdam, writes about him here and there. There's been almost no work done on him. He's really kind of... So it's a great question. My question is, I can't believe so little has been done, but because we need something to do. Maybe one more question? Okay, thank you very, very much. It's been an honor.